The last time I did this type of video, it was on Jensen's Gradiva, which comes from The Complete Psychological Works of Sigmund Freud, Volume 9. Embedded in that volume, also, it has other collected works. And I didn't get around to talking about any of the other collected works. So today's video, I'm going to briefly talk about the other collected works. Did you know Sigmund Freud made contributions to forensic psychiatry? In 1906, Freud gave a lecture titled Psychoanalysis and the Establishment of the Facts in Legal Proceedings. Of note, this has some historical significance because this is the first place published where we find mention of Carl Jung from Sigmund Freud. I found an article by Robert Lloyd Goldstein, MD, who is a forensic psychiatrist with Columbia University. And apparently he's also read Volume 9 because he wrote this article titled Sigmund Freud, Forensic Psychiatrist. It's worth a read. I'll include it in the description box below. Let's check it out. In the article, he mentions, and I'll quote, Freud dealt with issues that still interest and challenge forensic psychiatrists. Two kind of highlights he makes is one falls under the theoretical. Freud wrote Psychoanalysis and the Establishment of the Facts in Legal Proceedings, and also some character types met with in psychoanalytic work. And then the second one is practical applications, which consists of the expert opinion in the Hausmann case and memorandum for the defense. And Dr. Goldstein notes, in these forensic psychiatry writings, Freud made some original contributions, outlined areas for future investigation, and constantly advanced the thesis that psychology is a knife that cuts both ways. Again, I recommend you read that. It's very helpful. On page 113 of my volume, Freud writes, in your examination, you may be led astray by a neurotic who, although he is innocent, reacts as if he were guilty, because a lurking sense of guilt that already exists in him seizes upon the accusation made in the particular instance. You must not regard this possibility as an idle fiction. You have only to think of life in the nursery, where such events can often enough be observed. It sometimes happens that a child who has been accused of a misdeed strongly denies the charge, but at the same time weeps like a detected sinner. You may perhaps think that the child is lying when he asserts his innocence, but this is not necessarily so. It can be that he has in fact not committed the particular crime with which you have charged him, but that he has committed one of which you know nothing and of which you are not accusing him. He therefore quite truthfully denies being guilty of the one misdeed, while at the same time betraying his sense of guilt on account of the other. In this respect, as in so many others, the adult neurotic behaves just like a child. I thought this quote was interesting. It called to mind some different times where maybe I've worked with someone in therapy where they were experiencing guilt, and maybe when they told me about the feelings of this guilt and some of the thoughts associated with it, it seemed irrational. And part of me thought, I wonder if this guilt is appropriate. It's just from something else, not the event that they're attributing it to. Maybe they felt guilt during this event. But I wonder if it's really guilt from before that was never resolved, and now it's just carrying over into this event, and it's so big that it seems irrational to feel this much guilt for this event that they're telling me about. And I wonder if there's something deeper, something further back that they never worked through a resolve that's now cropping up in this context. Another quote that I thought was interesting, it came from one of the collected works in this volume is titled Creative Writers and Daydreaming. It was written in 1908. Might we not say that every child at play behaves like a creative writer, and that he creates a world of his own, or rather rearranges the things of his world in a new way which pleases him? It would be wrong to think he does not take that world seriously. On the contrary, he takes his play very seriously, and he expends large amounts of emotion on it. As people grow up, then, they cease to play, and they seem to give up the yield of pleasure gained from playing. But whoever understands the human mind knows that hardly anything is harder for a man than to give up a pleasure which he has once experienced. Actually, we can never give anything up. We only exchange one thing for another. What appears to be a renunciation is really the formulation of a substitute or surrogate. In the same way, the growing child, when he stops playing, gives up nothing but the link with real objects. Instead of playing, he now fantasies. He builds castles in the air and creates what are called daydreams. I believe that most people construct fantasies at times in their lives. This is a fact which has long been overlooked and whose importance has therefore not been sufficiently appreciated. So a couple of things about that quote. I think the first thing I thought of was The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. I love that movie. And how at the beginning of the movie, it shows there's all these different daydreams he's always engaging in. And then as he gets back out into the world and he's living out these things that maybe he would have typically daydreamed about, his daydreaming decreases. Another kind of quote that's embedded within this quote that I really appreciated was when Freud said, "What appears to be a renunciation is really the formation of a substitute or surrogate." I think it's very important to understand and realize that we don't give anything up. We replace it with something. And we understand that in, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy, you have this behavior that you're doing that you no longer want to do. Well, what are you going to do instead? We talk about replacement behaviors. Another point that Freud made on fantasies is from page 146. "We may lay it down that a happy person never fantasies, only an unsatisfied one. The motive forces of fantasies are unsatisfied wishes, and every single fantasy is the fulfillment of a wish, a correction of unsatisfying reality." When I first read this, I was a little bit offended because I daydream all the time. And I started to, and I appreciate my daydreams. I often daydream. And I started thinking, is it really true that if I were satisfied or happy, I would no longer daydream as much? It kind of reminded me of when I read this book by Alfred Adler, The Science of Living, where he was talking about dreaming. And he said, "The fact that dreams are emotionally intoxicating offers, curiously enough, a method for preventing dreams. If a person understands what he has been dreaming about and realizes that he has been intoxicating himself, he will stop dreaming. To dream will have no more purpose for him. At least this is the case with the present writer, who stopped dreaming as soon as he realized what dreaming meant." In that, he's talking about, sleep dreaming, not daydreaming, but he's mentioning he understood what dreaming meant, and once he understood it, he no longer needed it, and then he stopped dreaming. I've always been a little bit confused or skeptical of that, and I was going to ask Dr. Eric Monsacher, but I haven't gotten around to it. But as I thought about it longer, though, it is very helpful to ask patients if they fantasize and what they fantasize about. Kind of gives you a clue, especially if you look at it as a fantasy, as a wish fulfillment, kind of gives you a clue of what they're looking for, what would make them feel better, what would increase their self-esteem. Sometimes just fantasizing about something increases your self-esteem, or at least your sense of it. I appreciate it, and I think it can be very useful to think about fantasies in that way. Another quote from this is, "Experience teaches us that for most people there is a limit beyond which their constitution cannot comply with the demands of civilization. All who wish to be more noble-minded than their constitution allows fall victim to neurosis. They would have been more healthy if it could have been possible for them to be less good." This quote reminds me of a conversation I have with Dr. Murray Stein, and I'm going to show you that clip here.
"Bad moods. Jung said that his father was too good. And when he came home, he was always in a bad mood because he had to be so good in front of his parishioners. He had to represent the ideal life, but that wasn't him totally. So part of him, his persona, part of him, but it wasn't that. And so he suffered, and the family got the worst part of him."
So I think this is a good point to consider. I think that what Freud is hinting at here is that societal standards, especially during Victorian era Austria, place certain expectations on the citizens. And the question is, is everyone likely to either fall in line or fall in order or obey every rule, law, regulation, societal norm? Is everyone going to come across as a saint or as the perfect model citizen? And for the people who aren't able to live up to those societal standards and norms, are they going to suffer psychologically speaking because of it? If they themselves internalize that expectation and they expect highly of themselves and they're not able to live up to that standard, that might be where the harsh superego comes into play. That quote I just mentioned was from page 191, and on page 192, Freud notes, "In many families, the men are healthy, but from a social point of view, immoral to an undesirable degree, while the women are high-minded and over-refined, but severely neurotic." So again, I think this is getting at that the implications of society and the way it's structured and societal expectations on men versus women. And what is that going to do to them? Is that going to be psychologically damaging to them? Is it going to cause psychological, mental health problems and concerns in the long run? And that was something that a lot of people didn't consider. And Freud here was pointing this out. So I think in a lot of ways, I have tended to see like early, you know, Freudian psychoanalysis as everything's intrapsychic, there's a conflict within, and kind of this happens in isolation. But I think in a lot of ways, Freud was hinting at the society of the time and the societal implications and how different expectations for maybe when versus whim. Expectations for men versus women at the time might have played into psychological neurosis and how that presented. So I just thought that was worth noting, and I wanted to share that. Okay, so that's my brief review. Let me know what you think in the comments about some of this. Did anything stand out to you? And what quotes maybe resonated with you? What came to mind when I shared the quotes that I did? And what would you like to see more of? I should be trying to release... I also read volume 10 recently, which was two case histories. So I'm going to be trying to make a video on that and sharing that with you all soon. Actually, we're just going to go right into volume 10. Volume 10 is two case histories, Little Hans and the Rat Man. I'm not going to go into this very much at all. I'm just going to pull out a few quotes that I found within the two case histories and share them with you all. First is from page 143. "It seems to me that we concentrate too much upon symptoms and concern ourselves too little with their causes." This is pretty straightforward. I think that this still happens a lot today, and a lot of times we don't know the causes, and we don't try to get at them right away. Sometimes they come out over a long period of time, if at all. But I've always liked the psychoanalytic emphasis on what led to this or what has caused it, and let's see if we can explore that. Another quote that goes along with the quote I mentioned earlier, where maybe you have irrational or too much guilt for the given situation, is taken from pages 175 to 176. It's kind of long, so bear with me. "I took the opportunity of giving him a first glance at the underlying principles of psychoanalytic therapy. When there is a misalliance," I began, "between an affect and its ideational content, in this instance, between the intensity of the self-reproach and the occasion for it. A layman will say that the affect is too great for the occasion, that it is exaggerated, and that consequently the inference following from the self-reproach, the inference that the patient is a criminal, is false. On the contrary, the analytic physician says, no, the affect is justified. The sense of guilt is not in itself open to further criticism, but it belongs to some other content which is unknown or unconscious, and which requires to be looked for. The known ideational content has only got into its actual position owing to a false connection. We are not used to feeling strong affects without their having any ideational content, and therefore, if the content is missing, we seize a substitute upon some other content which is in some way or other suitable, much as our police, when they cannot catch the right murderer, arrest a wrong one instead. Moreover, this fact of there being a false connection is the only way of accounting for the powerlessness of logical processes to combat the tormenting idea. So yes, I think this goes perfectly well with that quote from the volume before, where you have an overwhelming sense of guilt for a certain situation that to an onlooker seems irrational. Why are you feeling this much guilt or this much self-reproach given these circumstances or given this situation? And what Freud is saying is that this guilt is misplaced. It's grabbed onto a new situation or a new content, and it's showing up here. But really, this guilt comes from some prior experience, some prior event that was never worked through and processed through. And lastly, Freud hints here at secondary gain. So on page 199, he says, "The results of such an illness are never unintentional. What appears to be the consequence of the illness is in reality the cause or motive of falling ill." For those of you not familiar with secondary gain, what he would be saying here is that a lot of times someone might fall into an illness because of the unconscious hope for the gain or the reward or the consequences of the illness. A lot of the older psychoanalytic writers would write about this. I'm trying to remember the writer, but they talked about the wife. She was insecure that her husband would go out and stay out late and all these different things. And she started to become anxious and eventually became agoraphobic, was unable to leave the house by herself. And so his husband would come home early and take care of her and take her places that she needed to go. And this psychoanalyst was hypothesizing that the secondary gain that she received is that her husband is now more involved and taking care of her. And with her husband being more involved in taking care of her, she's not going to feel as insecure because he's not separate from her. So the hypothesis was, going along with Freud, that the cause or motive of falling ill is what appears to be the consequence of the illness. I hope that makes sense. Okay, we're wrapping up here. Now that I've got that out of the way, I can read volume 11 with a clean slate. Thanks for watching. I love you.